welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Sunday, April 7th, 2013. I'm your host, Greg Luca, and I'm joined by three writers today who may or may not discuss what they did on Friday night. We have Adam Pincus.
What's up?
Dude, what is... what? Okay. Well, okay. I wish this was a video show so we could see the Snickers bar caramel just hanging off his face at this moment. Phil Heilman's here.
How are you guys doing?
And Joe Morgan is here.
Good day.
Okay. Before we get into things sports related, which we're going to talk about spring football and then a little later, DeLandon's going to come back and we're going to talk a little basketball, but we got to talk about just random things that I have on my mind at this point. Pincus, do you want to tell the story of your Friday night? No?
We're pausing this.
No, we're not.
No.
Okay, fine. Then here's what I'll do. I'll tell you about yesterday. I don't go out a ton. People who know me know this. People on the podcast will probably know.
No.
But yesterday was my one of my roommate's 21st birthdays. So we went out to Grog, and there was some things that kind of just hung out there, and it was cool. And so we get back, and everything goes normal, and I think it's really good. And then this morning I wake up, and stuff is not necessarily where we left it. We had to find some things that weren't where they were supposed to be.
Was Ryan,
we had like a dozen or so people back at our
was
place.
Was Ryan
after.
Lochte at Grog?
I didn't see him. So, I mean, this is the reason why I was late, which is part of the reason I'm explaining this, because I had to find my things, which weren't where they were supposed to be, and then I was just about to walk out the door, and the kid whose 21st birthday it was, he comes out of his room, and he goes to the bathroom, and he's like, what the hell happened in here? And I think, Pincus, maybe you have some experience in telling me how to deal with this, but there is just vomit just everywhere, and I don't know, how do you even go about cleaning this up? I don't know how to figure out who did it. I don't know what my next move is.
Your first move is not to figure out who did it. I think you've got
more
pressing issues at this point.
It's going to smell.
We sprayed some like bleach and stuff on there, and then I left, and they're trying to handle it, I think.
You got to cut and run.
A couple weeks ago, I could top that. I found a handle of alcohol in my washer from the night before.
That's bold.
Spin cycle.
Thank goodness I saw it when I was cleaning my clothes before I actually turned it on, because that would have been bad.
Yeah, but if you managed to not, that would have been interesting.
That would have been a waste of alcohol. That's the biggest issue.
It probably would have broken my my washer and dryer.
Okay, but so for cleaning, I need we need to mop this thing.
Yeah,
you just need to attack it. You know,
get one of the fraternities to offer their pledges.
Is that the thing?
Yeah,
still like an online.
The fine young gentleman of ZBT would be more than willing to clean up
somebody's vomit. We'll never know. Anyway, other random topic is that WrestleMania is tonight, and I don't know, I think Brian Holt is having a gathering over at his place, which should be fun. I want to discuss this because I think people have, very different views on wrestling in general. I think the people who see it as a sport are like, you guys are dumb and this is stupid and why would anybody watch this? And the people who understand it's just like a male soap opera are like, this is fun and I like this. Where do y'all stand? Anybody coming to this thing?
It's real, right?
No.
I just have no opinion of it. I don't really enjoy it, but I'm not going to look down on people who do. It's just a thing.
I think it's a little lowbrow for me, to be honest.
Really?
I know. That's very hard.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's surprising.
Yeah. Never really been a big wrestling fan. I can understand why people get behind it. It's got, I guess, some drama with some air quotes, but never been my thing.
Stacy Keibler was a wrestler, right?
I
think so. I
guess, yes.
Isn't that Clooney's gal pal?
That would make sense.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not, but it would add up.
Pretty sure she's a wrestler.
Yeah, insofar as the women are wrestlers, but I guess insofar as the guys are wrestlers too, so
yeah.
They're both fake. Okay.
Hold on. He mentioned George Clooney, and I was over at Andre's last night, and we were talking about who is the stud in Hollywood, right? And we were talking, old and young. And I was like, it's clearly Clooney for the older and Ryan Gosling for the younger. I mean, is there,
No.
Am I
Do you mean,
here?
The most desirable guy?
Yeah, the most desirable man in Hollywood.
Wow.
And some people start talking about Dwayne Wade, and I'm like, what in the world's going on here?
Ryan Gosling's retiring for a little bit. I don't know if you heard about that.
But he's still the man. Doesn't make him any...
I think the guy right now is Bradley Cooper. But this is getting a little weird. So
isn't DiCaprio always in these discussions?
Let's move on to football.
DiCaprio's kind of like Kobe now, though. You know what I mean? Like, he's been around for a while. He's still doing his thing, but you can kind of see the end of the run.
He's kind of like Kobe.
Which age bracket does Cooper fall in? Isn't he like 38? He's in like a gray area. Yeah, he's really, he's a lot older than you would think.
Because Bradley Cooper looks like he's 28, so.
He looks like he's 28, but I think, I'm almost.
He is 38.
He's 38, yeah.
He's great in Silver Linings Playbook, and Hangover 3 is coming out, so.
What was he doing the last 20 years, then?
His career arc has gone in a way that
Wedding Crashers?
I think few people thought it actually would. If you told me 10 years ago he'd be making something like Silver Linings Playbook, I would have probably just laughed right in your face because never expected him to be able to pull
off
those roles.
TV things.
Did you know Bradley Cooper and Gary Oldman have the same number of Oscar nominations?
Hmm. That says something. I'm not sure what.
It's kind of a cruel world, actually, but you know.
Okay. Oh, Joe, this is a good. I guess this is the best segue we would ever have to you doing a 5-second movie review.
Oh well. Man, I'm a little unprepared, but...
Whatever one you were going to do last time, because we totally ignored it.
Well, yeah, that's not out of the
ordinary. We always ignore them, regardless of whether he does.
True, but... Yeah, but at least he got to say most of them and can say it today, because that one we just didn't even let him speak.
All right, this is for Argo, and it's basically, if you haven't seen it yet, you're an idiot. That's the 5-second movie review.
Okay.
I like that.
I thought it was really good.
Can we just take 5 seconds, because I've had an argument with a coworker who seems to think that Zero Dark Thirty is better than Argo.
Which is just ridiculous.
It's
not.
Totally asinine to even believe. I mean, don't get me wrong. Zero Dark Thirty was a well-put-together film. I thought they did a good job of staying pretty factual and going about their business. But, man, it really, by the time they caught Bin Laden, I was uninterested.
The thing is like, it was a really well-made movie, but they somehow made me less interested in the killing of Bin Laden.
Yeah. Exactly. That's where I was. Argo, meanwhile, takes a lesser-known story, and I think it just is more well-rounded as a film. It's got comedy, drama, action. Zero Dark Thirty, to me, was just a documentary more than anything.
It was very tough for there to be, like, a exciting climax part because you kind of knew what was going to happen.
But, like, you know, it's just, hey, let's let Jessica Chastain yell at people for 2 hours, and then they're going to kill Bin Laden, and that's the movie.
Yeah. I didn't like how they developed Chastain's character that much, I'll be honest with you. But...
I'd be fine with her yelling at me for a couple hours.
Oh, there you go. We kind of knew it was going to get there at some point. All right, so actual things we're supposed to talk about. Spring football is over. I know we're all sad about that. We can go position by position, and we'll do that for the most part, but I want to just open it up first. If anybody had their opinion about anything changed just based on what we've heard or what we've seen
in
three practices
and
some quotes.
I wish I wasn't there yesterday.
Okay, that's fair.
But I had to be there, so I was.
I will say one thing, though.
The receiver, DeMarcus Robinson, kid's a stud. Really like him. Hopefully he stays healthy.
That was a big takeaway. For me, the biggest takeaway was sometimes with Will Muschamp, you never know what you can really take at face value. But his talking about the inconsistency of the kicking game is right on. we saw both Brad Phillips and Harden shank a few field goals yesterday. I think they both drilled the upright. And that's going to be hugely critical this season. Think back to last year, how many times Caleb Sturgis bailed out a stalling Florida offense with a 40 or 50-yard field goal. I mean, that just does so much for your momentum, both offensively and defensively. It takes the pressure off both units when you have a kicker who can come in and salvage a stagnant offense with 3 points on the board. And I don't think either one of those kickers can do that right now.
There was a kick that Brad Phillips made yesterday that looked like it was like skeet shot out of the air. You know, it was like, pull. Phillips kicked it.
Yeah, that was poor.
It was brutal.
Mean, obviously, with Sturgis, there was not a whole lot of worry about that. And I think it changed what they had to do on offense, too, in a lot of those situations.
Right.
And that'll be a big thing to watch in the fall.
Just think, who were the two most valuable players on the team last year, arguably?
No, don't say the kicker.
Shreve Floyd.
Caleb Sturgis and Kyle Christie.
Nope.
Christie,
I wouldn't say that they were the two most valuable.
Christie is going to be probably.
They were two of the players on the team.
Christie's
going to be an important player this year.
They were worthy of some swamp stud conversation last year.
Especially if they can't get consistent vertical passing game going and it's the same offense as last year.
That's the thing.
They won by switching the field.
Yeah, with an offense can't consistently move the ball, and this is something that Driscoll talked a little bit about yesterday, they can't hit on big plays. They don't have, at least last year, they didn't have the talent at wide receiver, and they didn't have the talent at some of the other positions to hit hit on these big plays where you have two or three play drives that go for touchdowns. This was an offense that had to methodically move the ball down the field, which just if you're playing the percentages, tells you you're not going to score as often. And there's going to be a lot more times where you're going to stall out and you're going to need the kicking game to come through for you. And I'm not someone who necessarily believes that the kicking game is hugely important under normal circumstances, but there are some games that were just totally swung by Christie's efforts and Sturgis, and Chris will be back, so I think you can expect pretty much the same from him. But, man, I just left yesterday really frightened for the Gators if they don't get the field goal kicking game turned around.
All right, I think we should move on from the kicking game.
Can't they find someone in the street
falling asleep a little bit?
Right.
So I think we should move on to something else.
So there's a lot of kicker things. Exciting.
Pincus needs to go out there and kick for him.
I could do it, yeah.
Yeah.
So Pincus talked about how dreadful the spring, air quotes, game was. Because of the fact that they only had six healthy linemen with the rash of injuries and Jessamyn Dunker being suspended. So for those of you who didn't watch it, were the lucky ones of us, it was basically just another open practice where they did five or six scrimmage periods of 11 on 11, which would have been like a spring game would be, except there's no stats or anything.
I think Orange won, by the way.
And
well, the one thing, we were lucky in the fact that we were actually there and not having to watch it on TV.
Which was even worse.
Great point.
They would cut away from the 11 on 11 stuff, the exciting things, quote unquote, for these random interviews or commercials, and everybody's seeing the special teams drills on TV, and those are awful.
I heard a lot of complaints about the coverage.
Yeah, they interviewed like the Sunnyland sponsor, like representative,
that's
for
important.
Like 5 minutes.
Well, I mean, they probably have to do that to make up for the fact that those people are making so much less money off of how terrible this event is.
Right.
It was
like, that was probably the trade off.
It's like the Sunday conversation on SportsCenter.
The whole thing was just a travesty and a nightmare.
And so as a result of the fact that those guys in the offensive line were hurt and Matt Jones didn't really do anything because they didn't need him to, and Dunbar and DeMarcus Robinson were both non-contact, the defense really stole the show, I guess you could say, in this thing, and were vastly the better unit by far, and the offense really couldn't get anything going. Even as Driscoll had the non-contact jersey and could never be sacked and had as much time as he wanted, they still didn't find a lot of open players.
And he missed a couple throws, too.
Right. So, I mean, is this enough for you guys to be any kind of concerned about the offense, or just one practice, just one spring, just whatever?
You know, Danny Werfel's always said that he wasn't a good practice player, right? But I just don't feel like, you know, Driscoll could say the same thing. You know what I mean? Like
Tebow, too.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Cam Newton probably outplayed Tebow that spring. I'm pretty sure that happened. But, you know, it's just, if you can't do it, like, in practice and stuff, then I don't see why there should be any confidence in you going into the game. That being said, you know, if you thought Driscoll looked bad, you should have seen Tyler Murphy, who looked like, you know, it was his first day playing football ever, because it was pretty brutal from that standpoint.
Yeah, and Morningway was pretty poor as well.
He'll come around, though. Morningway's
yeah, that's your boy.
Yeah, he's a coach's son.
Yeah.
It was not a good showing by just about anybody.
I don't think it's fair for any of us to pass judgment yet. Let's evaluate what we saw in terms of what they didn't have last year. Like, Robinson was a guy who can certainly make some plays. Kelvin Taylor looked pretty good, too, as maybe a secondary running back option. They didn't have that last year with, you know, Jones not really coming on until late. I think Matt Jones and Kelvin Taylor could be a nice 1-2 punch.
Yeah, I mean, Kelvin Taylor was pretty fast and looked shifty and all the things you want to see out of a freshman, and it doesn't mean a lot because it's the spring practice. But Matt Jones being basically named the number one starter heading into next year seems like a good move for them in terms of the style they want to play and what they want to do. What are your kind of expectations for him heading into the 2013 season?
I think he fits the offense really well. Muschamp has spoken at length about how Jones he's kind of like a Antonio Morrison type where he just really loves contact and he runs downhill. A big thing for him last year was he needed to get his pads lower. I know that's something that the coaching staff talked about and we haven't gotten a chance to really see that, but just given how strong he is and just how physical he runs, I think he'll do a really good job kind of passing the torch from Gillislee to Jones, and they're going to need him to be strong because the passing game is something that, I mean, it's a question mark, even with Robinson and Dunbar coming on. I think Dunbar had quietly a good season last year, but they're still going to need Jones and a change of pace back in Taylor to just do a lot of the heavy lifting.
he's obviously not Mike Gillisley. That remains to be seen whether or not he could duplicate what Gillisley did last season. But the role of running back for this offense is not changing. I don't see them running any less with the different guy back there. So in order for Florida to win, Matt Jones really has to carry the ball, hold on to it, and make productive plays from the backfield.
Right. They want to pass to the running backs more, which is the thing they've said so far this year, and I could see that with a guy like Jones in there instead of a guy like Gillisley, who Gillisley did not catch a lot of passes in his career.
The thing is, there's plenty of options back there. I mean, you got Matt Jones, who could be your workhorse. You got Kelvin Taylor, who, you know, probably needs to add a bit more size, but I mean, like, he's fast, he can do things. And then, you know, you have speed options with Solomon Patton, you can do some things with. You can do stuff with Adam Lane, who's coming in. I mean, there's just a ton of options back there. So, I mean, it's not going to be a shortage of talent.
And the guy that gets lost a lot is Mac Brown. I know he hasn't lived up to expectations.
Where was he yesterday? I didn't, like,
yeah, he didn't do a whole lot, but, I mean, that's a guy that's averaging, I think, more than 4 yards a carry in his career, and albeit in a limited sample size. But this is a guy that came in with high expectations, and I'm not saying that he's going to start getting 15 or 20 carries a game, but, I mean, if you need another a third back, you know, are you shaking your head?
Or
no.
Somebody I could have sworn you were talking about the Texas football coach.
Oh, okay. No, actually, Mac Brown, the guy who, for some reason, hasn't been able
to... Number 33.
Yeah, that guy. Yeah, he did a little bit yesterday. He bounced around a little bit. I think, I mean, if that's your number three running back, that's a pretty solid option.
Now, Muschamp seems to think the offense as a whole will be better because they have that depth at running back, because it's year two for Driscoll, because it's year two for Brent Pease, and because they have better talent at receiver and better talent on the offensive line, which we can talk about the guys we actually saw. DJ Humphreys battling his weight but playing left tackle. Max Garcia, the transfer, apparently has looked solid. Everything we've seen has been pretty good, and everything we've heard has been pretty good. Jonathan Harrison at center is solid. He'll be back for another year. I don't see why that would ever be in question.
Right.
Jalapio, probably going to start at right guard when he gets healthy. We saw Coney do some of that yesterday with the Mr. Versatility Kyle Coney there. And another transfer, Tyler Moore at right tackle. So any of you can, you can take one guy each. You can jump in however you want and talk about the unit as a whole, but give me something on the offensive line.
I like them. And especially getting two guys like Garcia and Tyler Moore. They've played Division I in college football. They've been there. It's not like this is two freshmen who don't know what's going on. So they have a veteran line, and I think it's going to be really good. And Muschamp, the players, everyone has been raving about Max Garcia and Tyler Moore. So I'm excited to actually see them in action when that time comes.
I'm just saying, if there's ever an opportunity where you can switch out Xavier Nixon and put somebody else there, that's always a win.
So they're automatically going to be better.
Yeah, they're automatically going to be better, at least from the blind side, you know.
Kuiper had Nixon as a second or third round.
I was just going to say, it was like second to fifth, somewhere in this range.
Yeah, maybe like in the doormat draft.
I just,
like, oh, you need a nice welcome mat for your house.
Wow.
I just, I
Xavier Nixon's a good second round pickup.
He's much bigger than you, Jeff. So.
Yeah, I know, but, you know.
I think a lot of scouts probably saw Xavier Nixon on film, on Jarvis Jones' film, as he was running by him constantly throughout the Florida-Georgia game. So maybe they just
bad publicity.
Well, he's a guy, so.
But my biggest takeaway, actually, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell with the offensive line in a system like that, in a scrimmage. You're not really doing a whole lot of the quarterbacks in the non-contact, but I think it definitely will be an improved unit. And I don't think they were as maligned as they were the year before anyways. Kind of a funny story for me is Tyler Moore. I had never seen the guy before. This kind of shows my ignorance. I've written a few things about him, but didn't know who he was. And I've got this history class, and there's this huge guy in it. And I'm like, man, that guy should totally be on the football team. He could totally start at, like, left tackle or any position at this point. We wrote, I think, last week about how they only had 6 linemen. And we're sitting in class, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to tell this guy, hey, you should try out for the football team. I have no idea who you are, but, like, they've got literally nobody that can block the quarterback.
Which is a bold thing for you to do either way.
Wow. Right. This guy's huge. But, like, no, I decided not to do it. And I had actually thought about it yesterday because the class is Tuesday, Thursday. I'm like, man, after this spring practice, I'm going to make a joke about it because this guy, he's worn some Gator stuff before. He obviously pays attention. And then after we're in the postgame media, this guy comes walking in as Tyler Moore. And I'm like, oh, man, that would have been a crazy, embarrassing story if I had done that. But
great first impression.
Yeah. She totally played football, man.
Yeah, so now I'm going to try and be a little bit more buddy-buddy with him in class now that I know he's an integral part of the offense as much as any lineman really can
be. One thing about the offensive line, and you can take this for any of the positions like receiver, or cornerback. The offensive line goes up against a pretty solid defensive line in practice. And you talk to receivers, and they're always talking about how the cornerbacks make them better. That's also something that you can't really see, you know, on film, or there's no open practices, so you can't actually see what's going on. But I will say this, with Florida's really good defensive line, they're helping out the offensive line, you know, that much more, and vice versa. So I think that's a nice relationship that you have to keep in mind.
That's a good point. I think anytime you're getting those consistent reps on a daily basis against, you know, the Dante Fowlers, Leon North, a guy who is expected to come on a lot, and even last year against Floyd and Hunter, I mean, that's obviously pretty huge.
I miss Omar Hunter.
He's like the
dinosaur guy from the, you know what we're talking about, right?
Yes.
Can we just establish in the podcast that I was the first one to draw that connection?
Yeah, I shouted you out when you first mentioned it.
All right, cool.
Anyway, with DJ Humphries, the thing they're going to have to look out for is the weight. We'll see if he gets that up by the time the season starts, and then if he can carry it well. But the other position group that Muschamp seems happy with the increased talent at it is wide receiver. We already talked about DeMarcus Robinson, so we won't get into him. But as usual for spring, we hear good things about Quentin Dunbar. We hear good things about Andre DeBose. We see
Andre DeBose, the king of spring.
We
the
see
spring,
and hear good things about
spring All-Americans. I tell you what.
Andre DeBose was with the first team yesterday. That's like a huge step for him personally.
With Troy Pittman before he got hurt. So, I mean, do you believe in any of these guys?
At this point, I think it's kind of, I'll believe it when I see it. Muschamp talked at length last offseason before the year about the strides that Pittman was making. And obviously, in this league, especially in the SEC, it's hard for that position to come on and do things right away. And I think you're probably going to see more of that. I like Dunbar a lot. I think he's a guy that could have a breakout year. I liked him a lot last year. I think out of all the receivers, he was probably the only guy that was consistently getting separation. That didn't necessarily translate into results. A lot of passes that got missed and some big plays that didn't quite get hit. But for the rest of them, with DeBose especially, until I see some consistent play on the field, I'm probably not going to take it more than a grain of salt.
Who knows? I'm cautiously optimistic. And it's maybe a little fool's gold. But also, keep in mind, it's just like everybody blames the offensive line when the quarterback gets sacked 5 times. The receivers may be doing certain things, and Jeff Driscoll may not be finding them. I mean, that could also be it. It could be a little bit of both. So that is something to, you know, watch out for. Maybe the, you know, Driscoll isn't doing what he needs to do. I don't know. I'm not a football coach. I just write about football sometimes. So maybe that's it.
Right. I mean, I don't think Driscoll is great, and that'll remain to be seen. But as far as the receivers go, I can't trust any of these guys until we see it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because this is the third year in a row that we've heard that Quentin Dunbar had a great spring and was primed to do some things in the fall, and it never, ever, ever happens.
He didn't have a terrible year last year, I feel like. I feel like people give him... I mean, no, he didn't.
He came on in the second half of the year.
I mean, the Florida State game, he played really well. I mean, you can't make an entire season off of one game, but I thought there were some times in watching some of the games afterwards on tape that Dunbar looked pretty good.
Well, they didn't throw it very much last year, so right. I'm willing to look the other way and be cautiously optimistic about what the season holds for them, you know, this upcoming year.
I will say that optimism is something that was lacking last year. I don't think, outside of Pittman, they were really talking about anybody. They talked about Andrade a little bit, but there wasn't anybody that really even gave you any hope that things were going to change. But now you've got, obviously, Robinson. Ahmad Fullwood is a guy that they've talked a lot about. He hasn't come to campus yet, but he'll be here for the fall, and a few other guys that could maybe make a difference at some point this season down the line.
Right. I mean, they didn't throw the ball a lot, but Dunbar still had 36 catches in 13 games, which isn't great, especially for a guy who's, you know, getting older, getting supposedly progressing and getting better, and it's not really translating. So, again, we'll see. I don't know. I don't pretend to know for sure what's going to happen with that. But the one area we haven't talked about on offense, and the biggest problem area, at least as they've outlined it to us, is tight end. When Clay Burton is listed on top of the depth chart, you know that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's also Tevin Westbrook, who was a defensive player not too long ago, and then Kent Taylor and Colin Thompson, who were both freshmen who did pretty much nothing last year. So what is up with this position? Where are they going to go from now until the fall?
Well, I think Colin Thompson has talent. The problem is that he had the foot injury last year, and so he was away from football for a while. So, I mean, I feel like if he can you know, get up to speed physically and...
He's more of a blocking
guy. Yeah, but I mean, it's better than having Clay Burton, you know.
If there's one lasting image from the struggles of offense last year, it was the Burton to Burton malfunction.
Yes.
That was a hell of a play. That made me laugh a little bit.
I saw a picture just the other day where Burton is laying on his back like a turtle and the ball just like squirting right next to him. Just the level of ineptitude behind Jordan Reed was just appalling last year.
Jordan Reed was a big time playmaker on offense. Maybe their only one besides Neil Gillislee.
Also converted, by the way, also a converted player from quarterback to tight end. So
yeah.
I think that's a guy that didn't get a ton of appreciation in the moment. I think people kind of realized that Jordan Reed was
good.
You know, he was good, but like nobody fully realized what a security blanket he was for Driscoll. I think it might have been in the Vanderbilt game or Tennessee where Driscoll threw him like against his body and hit Reed for a touchdown pretty far down the field. Just it seemed like Driscoll had more confidence throwing to Reed than anybody else by far. He was confident that he could get open and that it wouldn't be the ball wouldn't be intercepted. Jordan Reed would make some type of play on it, and there's nobody in this group right now that I think he's going to have that type of connection with. Colin Thompson, obviously, that's a guy that missed a bunch of time last year with the injury. He's going to be more of a blocker, but people seem to be pretty high on him. Kent Taylor is a guy that I think seems to have a lot of potential. The window seems to be open for him to step in, make a play, but kind of like the receiver situation where you just never really know what you're going to get until the season starts.
Yeah, and we're probably going to appreciate Jordan Reed a lot more this upcoming year when he's not here.
Yeah.
It's like we took him for granted, and it'll probably show once the season comes around. It may not. Maybe the collection of guys with Thompson providing, you know, the blocking, Kent Taylor being a guy out of the slot, making plays, maybe that works. But the absence of Jordan Reed looms large come this upcoming year.
The last position that we haven't talked about is fullback, where Hunter Joyer is obviously going to hold it down.
Stud.
I have sort of brushed off the storylines about Raheem Ledbetter and getting a job he's switching over because I don't think they're going to play that much, and I doubt they're going to be that good playing a position they've never played for the first time. But if you guys want to, if you've seen something from one of them or if you believe that either of them is going to make a contribution at that area, now would be your time to say so.
Well, I mean, I was talking to Matt Watts, Andy Stables yesterday, and they thought that if Gideon Ajogbe, I'm just telling you, what
just name drop Matt Watts on the podcast.
I'm just telling you right now, okay? Like more like they were talking, and I was just sitting there.
Okay,
but like, regardless, they were sitting there. If Gideon Ajogbe gets to do anything at fullback, it does give them more options. If he can provide any sort of service, you know. And I mean, Muschamp was making a good point
in
yesterday.
In terms of like using Hunter Joyer as a running back.
Well, like, no. In terms of like Gideon Ajogbe has like he's more agile. He's quicker.
He was an athletic linebacker.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So like they could roll him out in the flat, and if his hands are soft enough, he can catch something. I don't know. It just gives him another option to think of. You know,
Hunter Joyer do the same thing?
No, he's not as quick. And you know, I mean, the thing is with Joyer is like you know he's just your kind of a lead blocker type guy. You know, and
well, we saw him get the ball a couple times, and it wasn't terrible.
Yeah, but, you know.
You're probably not going to consistently go there.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Muschamp did make a salient point yesterday in saying that with Joyer being the main guy, they're one injury at that position away from not being able to go to too much two-back sets and a lot of the things that they like to do. So developing some depth is going to be really important because Joyer's a guy that's been great for them. I think Mike Gillislee would be the first one to tell you how important he was to last season's team. But at the same time, if that's a guy that, you know, rolls an ankle or just gets nicked up early in the season and he's out for a couple of games or a couple of series even, that totally changes the outlook of the offense for that period of time.
Right. I guess my issue is I can just kind of envision a scenario where Ledbetter and Ajogbe both never play and it just doesn't matter at all. But
wasn't it the Jacksonville State game where Joyer got injured and they had to put Mark Herndon in there?
Yes.
And he was just getting dominated, consistently?
I don't think
who was it?
Huh, that's a good
Scott
question.
Scott Peake, that's what it was.
Yeah. Sorry, number my apologies to Mark Curtin, but Scott
Peake. Had a great game yesterday.
Yeah, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay, but my apologies to Herndon and his family and his close ones, whatever. Scott Peake, yeah, just Joyer was out against Jacksonville State, you know, and just like you've got to have someone back there who can do something, you know. I'm just saying.
Scott Peake, I think
God bless you, Greg Luca.
I think he's trying to go out for the U.S. bobsled team right now, so that tells you about as much as you need to know about his football prospects.
Story?
No, I think it is.
Well, I think he has to write that. He did have a I think we talked to him after that game. Did he score a touchdown, maybe?
I don't think he scored a touchdown, but he was made available after the game for
because of senior day or something.
For whatever reason, so I'm pretty sure that he's... Mr. Luca's looking it up right now, but I think he's...
He guys Bob's letter on after football. What is going on?
Yeah. I mean...
Cool Runnings. Yeah, man.
That's a great movie, but I don't know if... if your second string fullback is graduating and immediately goes to try out for the U.S. bobsled team, that probably tells you there's a lack of depth there, and... in an offense that runs the ball just a majority of the time and two-back sets and uses the fullback and utilizes it as a position that most teams are going away from that. You're going to the spread. You're going to all these passing attacks. But Muschamp and Pease have really looked to establish a pro-style offense, which still does utilize the fullback quite a bit. And Hunter Joy is going to be important to keep healthy this year, and finding somebody that can do some type of Hunter Joyer things behind him is going to be important too. All
right, are we done talking about the fullback?
Yeah, I was going to move to the defense.
Let's move on.
I've had my fill on fullbacks.
I know. I get it. I'm fullbacked out.
I don't get that one. Okay,
that wasn't a pun. I was just I just made a word up.
Okay, the defense.
I just made a word.
At defense, we're going to start at my favorite position, which is Buck linebacker / the one opposite Buck linebacker or Sam, but I don't know that they're going to be that much different in the fall because they're going to have to find a way to get Ronald Powell and Dante Fowler Jr. both on the field. What are your kind of expectations of that group, and what did Fowler show you in the spring? Anybody go? Somebody. Joe, you're up.
I mean, Fowler's... I liked what I saw from Fowler last year. I mean, yesterday he didn't... I mean, nothing seemed out of the ordinary with him, you know? I don't know.
Are we going to get... Is Powell coming back? Is that necessarily going to happen? I know that's a guy... He tore his ACL in the last spring game and re-injured it in October, and they've been saying that he wouldn't be available for the spring and he'd be back for summer and fall, but those ACL injuries are tricky at that position. You've seen a lot of guys come back from it, but at the same time, until he gets back on the field and works up some reps, I don't know if you can necessarily count on him, but that's a huge guy. In terms of with Floyd gone, some of the other pass rush gone.
I like their versatility and their core group of guys on the defensive side. Last year they had a nice core group. This year, with Ronald Powell coming back, hopefully, you got Powell, Jonathan Buller, defensive end, Easley, who can play inside and outside, and Fowler, who's versatile in his own right. That's a nice little group of guys that you can work around. So I think they'll be fine. And Fowler's a stud. He really is. He had a great year last year. And he had a nice day yesterday, too, at the spring open practice, game, whatever you want to call it.
I mean, I'm a little bit worried about Powell because we haven't seen him in so long.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If he comes back, will he be the same? How long does he need to get back into his normal form? How good is his normal form?
We were expecting him to be a superstar, and he might have...
I don't know that he was even on the way, is honestly the way I'm thinking about it. But
he arrived here as...
Right, no question he did. Yeah. But
Dan Quinn's a guy that, for most of the time, I like to take his word at face value. And he was a guy that he was saying last year that Powell was someone he was expecting to really step into that elite level of defenders that, like in the SEC, some like Markievicz Bingo and some other... Barkevious Mingo. Sorry.
No less ridiculous of a name.
Yeah, I mean, anyways, just with Powell being hurt, that was a guy that Quinn said was a huge loss on the defense. And I think if they could get him back to, you know, just the kind of level of play they were expecting from him, that's a huge addition.
Because Powell can rush, he can, you know, defend against the run, he can do a lot of things. And that's a big deal.
I think that Fowler showed more last year than Powell really showed in 2 years. Because I remember Greg Luca wrote that column about Powell's sacks from his sophomore year and how only two of them were really, you know.
Like where he did anything. Yeah.
Yeah. So if Ronald Powell comes back, I just see it as a bonus for this defense as a rotation guy. So when it can give Fowler a breather and then maybe do some things. You know, I mean, he's talented. I mean, there's no question that he's talented. It's just a matter of putting it together and really doing anything about it, you know. But,
right.
You got to go with Fowler because I feel like he's shown more and I feel like he will do more.
If Fowler and Powell aren't both on the field, then opposite them is going to be Darren Kitchens or Nyron Ball, or they have Jeremy Powell listed here, which is weird. But Ball is a guy who caught a lot of people's attention yesterday from just what I saw on Twitter and what I've heard. And what are your expectations for him heading into next year?
Well, the thing with Ball is, like, a lot of last year he was just trying to get back into the swing of things, you know? Like, he was putting weight back on. And I remember he was talking about how he was always, like, battered and bruised and stuff. And, I mean, that happens when you're, you know, in a hospital bed away from the practice
room
and everything.
You go through what he went through.
Yeah, I mean, he's a talented guy. And he's probably, I mean, if anything, like, I'm not one for, like, intangibles and stuff. I mean, after going through an experience like that, it's got to give you kind of an edge, you know what I mean? Like, when you're, you know, fighting for your life, really.
Yeah, right. Something that impressed me about him yesterday was just his speed. They ran an end-around with Purifoy, I think it was.
Oh,
and
he blew that up.
Yeah, and Ball just caught him and pulled him down. And that's a guy that has always been pretty quick at the linebacker spot and kind of offers some versatility as opposed to, you know, like Powell and Fowler, who are more power bull rush guys at times. And I like Ball's quickness and agility on the outside. Maybe a guy that can cover and help the loss of Jelani Jenkins, who was known as a really good cover linebacker.
Now then, in the middle, since we're talking about linebackers, the two starters are likely going to be Antonio Morrison and Michael Taylor, at least what it looks like right now. Joe, you wrote a big feature on Morrison for Friday's paper, so I'll let you talk about kind of him and your expectations for him next year.
That was a solid story, by the way, Joe.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, Morrison's just a big hitter. He's a guy who really stepped into a role last year. I remember during fall camp last year, Dan Quinn was really talking him up, being like, this Antonio Morrison guy is really, like, a big deal. And I feel we were all a little cynical, especially with all the spring studs that come out of Florida. Like, oh, yeah, right, like this guy.
Yeah.
And then, like, Jelani Jenkins breaks his finger in the Texas A&M game. And then Morrison comes in and just kind of sets the world on fire and becomes a key guy in that rotation. And, you know, I mean, that big hit on E.J. Manuel in the Florida State game, like, is, you know, stuff of legend around here right now, you know. I mean, I love my story with it. But, I mean, yeah, he's a guy who just really goes hard all the time. I know Muschamp, like, had to scold him during spring practice for putting a pretty big lick on Kent Taylor when they weren't in pads. So, I mean, he's a guy who's, you know, ready to go. I don't know what other word to use there, but with him in an increased leadership role and a year of experience in the SEC, and he already said he knew how to play Mike from last year, so I feel like he's going to be a really big playmaker for this defense this year.
That knockout blow on Manuel, man, that
hurt me for the press box.
That was one of the probably top three or four plays of the year in terms of just importance. I think you look back at the Elam stripping, Odell Beckham in the LSU game kind of changed the dynamic of that game. But also, I can't think of too many other plays that were
Purifoy fumble against South Carolina.
Yeah, Connor.
Right,
Connor.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are three or four plays, but, I mean, it was right up there in terms of just the level of importance. And I think, like Joe said, that's a guy that can step in at the mic spot and help offset the loss of the John Bostic pretty quickly.
I like Mike Taylor, too. I mean, he's, you know, playing time hasn't been too consistent, but he makes plays when he's in there. And he has a sweet haircut. He's the guy with
always important.
Yeah, with the blonde mohawk or whatever he got going on. I like
Josh Evans.
Yeah, I like that look. I'm thinking about doing it. We'll see about it. But
all right.
Yeah, definitely
something
a,
to keep
definitely
an eye on
a fan. Definitely a fan of the Honey Badger haircut. So
we've got to go to the video podcast at some point so we can get the snickers on the mouth, the blonde hair coming from Pincus. Whenever Pincus is on it, we got to incorporate some video at some point.
You know, just going back to Morrison, though, I mean, like, with him at the middle linebacker spot and just what coaches have said about him and what we have on the field as proof, which is a big thing that, you know, it's kind of a question mark with the receivers.
That is the thing.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that's why I have confidence that this defense isn't going to really drop off that much. It's the depth in the secondary and then just the fact that Morrison's going to be there, and I feel like he's ready to go from that standpoint.
Those two have to pick up all of the communication and the running the defense things, but other than that, I think they've shown that they can step in and probably not be at the Jenkins and Bostic level, at least not at first, but at least have the potential to get there and be solid from day one.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the defensive line, the end position is where they're really solid. You have Easley and Bullard. Jonathan Bullard.
Easley's going to play inside at the start of the year.
Maybe. It's not 100%
yet. That's what they said.
They said, like,
if
the season
started
today, but it doesn't. Yeah. So, for now, he's still an end, and we'll talk about the tackle situation in a second. But, I mean, end seems like a situation where they're very solid because Easley and Bullard are both very good players, and Bullard certainly has the potential to get even better.
Yeah, Easley coming back, that decision, I think, was really important for this defense. He was one of the few guys that decided to stay or just with graduation was able to stay. I think he really locks down that defensive end position. I mean, he's also a guy that kind of like Joe was talking about, the intangibles are there in terms of just completely crazy. Like, you've got no other way to explain it. He's just, like, the guy is just, I mean, he's kind of off his rocker a little bit. But I think that's something that the rest of the defense especially kind of, like, gravitates behind and can really fire them up when he comes out and just does something totally insane and sets the tone against the other team. But also his on-field production is just pretty solid.
Yeah, I mean, Easley's another year smarter. That knee's another year stronger after the ACL tear from 2011. I mean, as long as he stays healthy and everything goes okay with him, you know, should be.
I do think we're going to see somebody step up, maybe a redshirt freshman or somebody we didn't see last year. Maybe like Brian Cox. I know he kind of plays both, you know, rush linebacker and whatnot. He made a couple plays in the backfield yesterday. I do think Florida's going to need one of those guys among that group of, you know, five or six players to just step up and take that next step and really force the coach's hand by giving them more playing time.
Yeah. Brian Cox, who was asked by a reporter last week how the linebacker spot was shaking up because he had no idea that he didn't play that position.
Well, what are you going to do? We never start this guy, so whatever happens, happens.
I think Brian Cox is the name of an actor, by the way.
I mean, his dad played in the NFL, right?
Yeah, his dad played for the Jets and the Dolphins, I think.
He had a big old thingy.
That was what he's best known for.
There's also a Brian Cox actor.
Okay.
All right, Joe.
No worries.
I'm going to IMDb him right now.
So, they're good at Ed, like we said, because especially with a guy like Bullard, who was highly recruited and showed some things, and we'll see where he goes in year two. But tackle is a different story, where they have four guys of Leonard, Darius Cummings, Damian Jacobs, and Joey Ivy battling for two spots in there.
Ivy's a pretty big kid.
They have him listed at 6'4", 269.
I mean, he looked much bigger yesterday. He was kind of the guy that stood out, number 91, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Bear Cummings, I guess. Darius Bear Cummings, someone that they've talked up a lot. And then I think they've got Trenton Brown also coming in, someone that could, you know, probably not play a whole bunch of snaps, but he could get in there and mix it up a little bit. But, yeah, with Hunter and Floyd, yeah, with those two gone, that's going to be a pressing need to fill that because that was a really important position. And I think Leon Orr is a guy that's going to need to step up. I don't know if you guys have seen anything from him, but
it was interesting that Coach Muschamp said that if the season starts tomorrow, Easley's going to play inside
because he needs more consistency from these guys. It's
What I'm saying. That's where I was getting at. Muschamp is basically saying he's talking to these guys right now, step it up. You're not getting it done. And moving easily inside that's probably as clear as day. That you gotta get your act together.
Right. I kind of thought Jacobs was good last year, but
yeah, he was pretty good.
Yeah, he was.
My sort of evaluation is going to be based on that there's a couple of plays where I notice him sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so then if the argument is that he's inconsistent, that could very well be entirely true because I'm talking based on a couple of plays where he does something good.
Right.
So I'm not going to tell Muschamp if he's wrong about that. So maybe Jacobs isn't as good as I kind of felt like he was, and certainly don't know much about these other guys because we haven't seen them before spring. But
I think Easley's going to be inside from at least the early part of the year, you know? I mean, because
it makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, because you can stick Bullard and have Easley in the inside, and obviously you can be rotating guys in and out. They don't play the full 80 snaps or whatever it is, but I mean, yeah, I just feel like it's the best thing for this defense right now.
No, let's talk about the secondary a little bit, which I think is the most talented sort of group on the whole team. You got one thing,
Real
Joe?
Quick, Brian Cox was in the Bourne movies with Matt Damon, Emmy Award-winning actor. I told you.
How do you spell Brian?
B-R-I.
Wrong guy. Not the
same name. I'm just saying that
his cousin or something.
Okay, sorry. Continue to the secondary.
Well, yes. I said this earlier about the receiver is getting helped by the secondary and how this relationship kind of works. Why are you guys laughing?
No, just the whole Brian Cox thing was funny.
Oh, okay.
No, go ahead. You didn't do anything. You're good. You're good.
Well, I mean, you just talk to these receivers, and that's all they could talk about is how good these defensive backs are. They're saying they're best in the nation, which, you know, they may just be saying that just to say it.
No fly zone.
But these guys are really good. And you look at who they got. Roberson, great. Watkins, who can play anything.
Oh, my God. We never talked about Luchez Purifoy when we were talking about wide receivers.
And Purifoy.
I mean, I mentioned it.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I think it was mentioned, but yeah, he's.
I kind of figured once he moved on that we could talk about it right now.
Okay.
Well, Purifoy, Mr. Athleticism, he can do anything. I mean, they really got a nice group of guys that they can work around.
What's interesting for me looking at the group is there's a lot of talented players, but I couldn't give you even a guess about who's starting.
There's gonna be an odd man out, whether it be Cody Riggs or there's somebody that deserves to start that's not gonna be able to play the cornerback or safety position.
And they talked about bleeding some of that depth into the safeties too.
Right, Watkins moving over has been especially discussed. But one of the things that's super interesting to me is you could build a great secondary out of the players they have right now, and then Hargreaves is supposed to be the best recruit that they have, and a lot of people think he's just going to start right away. So, I mean, how do you guys? What do you guys? If you had to pick the starting secondary right now, what would it look like?
Probably Roberson and Purifoy on the outside, and then Watkins at safety, and
a lot of guys that they can rotate. And I'll be really interested to see how much this Hargreaves kid can come in and make a difference and if he can earn time right away, because it's not a spot that you can come in and just play average and still get snaps. He's going to have to come in and really prove his he was worth this number two overall recruit ranking if he's going to sniff the field at all.
What I think is really interesting about that is I don't think they would want to use, I don't know a lot about him as a player, full disclosure, but I don't think they would want to use a guy like that in a nickel or dime role where it would be something different from just playing corner.
Yeah, what he's good at,
So then there really does become an odd man out because Brian Poole, who has looked good and I think could be kind of a ball hawk and do some interesting things as a nickel next year, would be on the field ahead of either Roberson or Hargreaves or potentially Watkins if they don't move him to safety or Riggs, depending on how that whole situation works out. So, I mean, we got one starting projection there. I think somebody gave me theirs. So the other two of you can shout out.
It's going to look like that. And you know what? This is a great problem to have. I mean, they have a lot of good guys that are capable. I mean, I'd rather have that than what you have at defensive tackle where you're moving easily inside because you don't have anybody else.
Didn't Watkins lead them in picks last year, or like second or something?
I believe he had the stats up.
Yeah, really good season.
He quietly. That's another guy that a lot of people talked about. They weren't really hugely high on. A lot of the headlines got stolen by Purifoy, obviously, because he did so many things, and Roberson just because maybe he was a bigger name. But Jalen Watkins quietly. I don't have the stats right in front of me.
Elam had four interceptions, and Evans and Watkins both had three.
Okay. So there you go. And I think one of them was a pick six against Kentucky. So he's a guy that can make some plays for you, too.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. Pincus, do you have an official projection? Are you thinking it's just going to be...
I think it's going to be Purifoy, Roberson on the corners, maybe Hargreaves. Honestly, if he comes in, he's going to be here in the fall, right?
Yeah.
Right. If he comes in and he's as talented as they say he is, you got to get him on the field. I mean, that's just the bottom line.
Right.
So if that's the case... Somebody is, not playing.
So does Watkins start at one safety, and then who starts at the other?
I think you got to get Watkins in.
Maybe
somewhere.
You slide Roberson over if you put Hargreaves at the other corner spot?
I don't know if he's trained back there to know what he's doing.
Yeah.
I don't know about Gorman and Showers. We didn't see a lot of them last year. I don't know.
My chance been very high on both those guys. Those are two that I think need to step up for Florida because, the depth in the secondary, these guys play a lot of snaps regardless. I mean, talk to Muschamp. He hates having to field questions about who's starting and what's going on because really, with the way they play, everybody gets in, everybody starts. So,
right.
They're going to get snaps. So that's, it's not an issue of whether they play.
He'll start two quarterbacks to make a point.
Yeah.
And that depth at defensive back also is something that we kind of alluded to earlier. Maybe gives you the flexibility to see what Purifoy can do at receiver a little bit more than if you were counting on him to play almost all the snaps at cornerback or another position. You might not have had the luxury to see what he could do at receiver. But that's someone...
They would not have. I mean, yes, having a playmaker at receiver is a need, but they would not have wasted half spring practices putting Purifoy at receiver if they didn't have enough talent or bodies at the secondary position.
Right. Exactly. How do you guys see that working out with Purifoy? How many snaps on offense per game next year, that sort of thing?
I would love to say, like, a lot, but I don't. Yeah. I just don't.
I mean, he's so good at defensive back that you got to put him there sometimes. But you look at what this team needs the most. It's not a quality cornerback because they have those. It's somebody at receiver who can make plays consistently.
Pierre so kind of a,
my, I mean, my preference would be to majority, you know, get him the ball. You know, whatever that is.
Right.
Maybe punt returns, kick returns, end arounds, screens, anything. He needs to just do work because he is probably, I think, their biggest playmaker.
Yeah, moving him to receiver is kind of one of those Robin Peter to pay Paul situations. But at this,
that's a good one.
But at, but at this time, if you're Robin Peter, the defense, they're kind of rich, whereas Paul, the offense, is kind of on welfare right now. So I think it's an okay thing to do. That's and I think, I think just with his talent, I mean, we saw a little bit. I think he had a couple of catches last year. I mean, he was really just kind of starting to scratch the surface on just even the idea of using him on offense. But if you can get him, like you said, to do maybe one or two end arounds a game or take a couple of deep shots with him just to stretch the defense a little bit, open things up for the running game and some of the other things they want to do more consistently, at the very least. I mean, at best, he turns into one of these guys, Chris Gamble type from Ohio State, where he can make a difference on offense, still do some things defense, and also contribute on special teams. I mean, the sky's the limit with this guy.
Yeah. All right. I think that's a lot of football. Do we have anything else you guys want to touch on?
Baseball, maybe. The Marlins are winning.
That's a surprise.
I mean, like, we're going to move over to basketball in terms of other sports. You want 2 minutes on UF baseball?
Sure.
Smooth transition. Go ahead.
All right, Tinkus, hop on in.
I was thinking about this earlier. What show was that when we were kids where we had
an interesting start?
Where we had the girl on the swing who tried to make the full revolution?
Recess?
Yes. That's what I see the baseball team as that. It's like that girl where they pick up momentum, they're trying to make, you know, go all the way around. And then when they finally get to that apex where it's like either going all the way around or you're coming back down and starting over again, they're coming back down.
Huh.
And it's happened over and over again. You look at this, you know, past weekend, they're playing it. I think they're probably starting right now with Magliozzi starting, which is a big deal.
Hey, you read a column about that.
I did. Kevin O'Sullivan, the coach, must have read it.
And said,
Yeah, this kid's pretty smart. He knows what he's talking about. But you look at Jonathan Crawford's start Friday night against Mississippi State. He throws the complete game shutout a week before. It looked amazing. Team won, you know, came into the Mississippi State series winning three in a row. You know, everything's going well. This team's going to turn the corner. And then, oh, the balloon popped. And bad start. It's a bad game all the way around. And Florida's, you know, now fighting to against Mississippi State to not get swept.
Right. They had a couple. They had a six-game losing streak pretty early in the year. And then obviously lost a couple in a row here and lost at least three or four
it's,
in a row.
It's been frustrating.
Why didn't Carmichael go to Starkville?
That'll probably be addressed next week. Yeah.
Because he's been pitching pretty... I mean, he had a bad game last Friday, but, I mean, other night, he's been pitching pretty well.
That's definitely something that will get addressed early next week, I imagine. So, but, yeah, it's been a trying season. And if you look at their schedule, there are games that they should have won. And it's gonna stink when you come, you know, regional time. They may not make it because of, you know, losing against teams like, you know, North Florida, you know, extra inning games, Georgia Southern, that they really should have won. Who knows? Maybe if they would have won those games, it would have been different.
Now, I mean, staying super big picture, the team is 14-16.
Yeah.
That's not very good. Nah, like, I assume they're not ranked anymore.
No.
Where are they?
They weren't even ranked after. I mean, the SEC, they're probably middle of the pack right now.
What are they?
It's so early.
So there's plenty of time for them to turn it around.
There is plenty of time, and also keep in mind their SEC schedule does become much easier. The second half, like right about now.
So they certainly have to pick it up, but not terrible, I think. Is there an MVP so far? Or MVP. A surprise player or something you want to, somebody you want to shout out individually?
Bader's been good.
Bader's, you know, gotten hot. Richie Martin's finally getting back to the lineup. He's starting in center field in the series finale against Mississippi State. He was doing very well at shortstop before he got hurt, you know, on March 3rd.
Schaefer's hitting .320.
Yeah, Schaefer has been a guy consistently. He's a doubles machine. Gushue is really coming on of late. Yeah, at the plate. Still needs some work catching.
Yeah.
I think you really look at it, the big picture is this team was not so much doomed from the start, but they were kind of behind the eight ball. You know, you lose Carson Wentz. I mean, that I feel pretty good about my team with Jonathan Crawford and Carson Wentz throwing, you know, first two games of the series, and he's not there.
Mm-hmm. And you have Jake Carmichael pop up.
Yeah, they got to get that starting pitching going.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was unfortunate circumstances, and they've kind of had to deal with that. So, I mean, give them credit. They're a young team. They're definitely improving.
Not really know too much, but didn't they have a couple of guys that they signed that ended up going to the majors that they were?
That is true, too. I mean, Lance McCullers was one. He was top recruit. Was like the 40th overall pick, something like that. Astros. I think it was the Astros game.
Sounds right.
Yeah, gave him a ton of money. Like, who's going to turn that down? Well, Carson Wentz did, but that's another story. So, yeah, I mean, they did get decimated by the draft, but that happens in college baseball, especially a team like Florida, who has top recruiting classes year in, year out.
Yeah, right.
So, that's not an excuse.
Right.
But, yeah, there are certain things that were going against them, you know, heading into this year.
Yeah, when you lose the Zunino, Tucker,
yeah,
Fontana that much, and then you have, you're counting on maybe some prospects who end up not coming to school as well, that puts you kind of behind the eight ball from the start. And I wouldn't say that 14-16 season at this point is altogether that surprising, especially given the Whitson injury and some of the other things that they've had to deal with this year.
Yeah, and then you also look, another big loss, Steven Paco Rodriguez, versatile lefty reliever. Mm-hmm. He's already in the big leagues. I don't know if you all knew that.
Yeah.
Playing for the Dodgers. He's killing it right now. But, yeah, that's he's a guy who could pitch, you know, 4-5 innings if necessary for them last year, which, I mean, they have that occasionally in Magnozzi. Carmichael was that earlier in the year. But they need somebody who can get righties and lefties out consistently from the bullpen, especially when you have starting pitching that's a little inconsistent. You got to have somebody in the bullpen that you can just count on to eat up innings and get people out.
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much the case as of late, but I remember early in the season finding that bridge from the starters to Magliozzi was
and the middle,
troubling.
The middle relief has improved a little bit. You have Danny Gibson. Young, who moved into the starting rotation. Depending on what happens with Carmichael, he's a guy who's really improved the last couple weeks. Daniel Gibson, another lefty, has had 4 or 5 consecutive outings that are really, really good. He's turned the corner a little bit. So they have a collection of guys. They just need, like, a guy to be that number one.
Right. Very good rundown. Good work, Pinkus.
Yeah. And also the solid press box food this year from the baseball
team. And important nonsense note, too.
I don't know if they're listening or if they ever do, but yes. Please, more ice cream, though.
More ice cream.
They had wings when I went
this
week. They were good.
Very good.
Yeah.
Good job, University of Florida.
Good job, John Hines, right?
Yeah.
John Hines is the man.
Yeah.
He really is.
Baseball SID.
All right. Lan's been waiting in the office for like 45 minutes, so we should probably stop this. Who wants to stick around for basketball?
You know what? If you're inviting me, I'll stick around for a little bit.
Sure. Are you inviting me, too?
No, we have to get rid of somebody.
If you guys want to stay, I'm more than happy to duck out.
Oh, God. All right. Well, either way, we're going to pause it, and we'll be back with Mystery Crew.
But I'm going to look around. I need some help. And I've decided to just disband the pitching staff and go for some offense because...
All right, man.
If you want to hop in on this, if you're interested in King Felix or David Price, they're official on the ball.
We'll talk after the podcast.
Okay. The podcast is going on right now.
Oh, okay.
We're just going to jump in live.
All right. I'm just saying that I have some... I'm dangling some hitters right now.
Is Justin Upton one of those hitters?
Baseball
what?
League talk.
Justin Upton one of those hitters?
Justin Upton is full no trade.
What if I offered
absolutely
you my
no
entire team? Still no?
No.
All right.
Devoted all right Braves fan, I like that.
I am trying to get BJ Upton right now, though. So
I'll try and swing that.
Here you get both of them. You have both of them.
Yeah.
Upton here.
Okay, we'll see if we end up keeping this in the show or not. But, Bill, I guess this is a good time for you to start talking about women's basketball, which is going to be totally unexpected and out of left field for the listeners. But WNIT Final Four run, it was pretty cool, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was a really frustrating season for them, I think. They lost 5 or 6 seniors from last year's tournament team. And coming into the year, they knew they were going to be young. They knew they were going to take some lumps. And they certainly did that in the SEC. They finished in a tie for 8th. They never really got things going during the regular season or the SEC tournament. And then you get stuck in the WNIT, and you never really know what the results are going to be. But Sydney Moss really carried that team. I think she averaged...
She's really good.
Yeah, she averaged 20 points a game, I think, in their five games in the WNIT. She completely took over against Florida International and did similar type things against Winthrop and Charlotte and James Madison before they lost to Drexel in the Final Four, where I think she especially kind of ran out of steam. She had 16 points in the first half and then didn't score again until there was, I think, less than a minute to go. I think playing five games in a two-week stretch for a freshman was asking a lot, especially they just essentially started asking her to do everything.
Also, to be fair, the dragon is higher than the alligator on the reptilian food chain, so it was only a matter of time.
Yeah, there not a whole lot of mascots would actually beat an alligator, and like if it was an actual brawl, but yeah, that one would.
A dragon would, so.
How many teams are in the women's NIT?
64. It's a full field.
Okay, so I was going to compare it to the men's NIT, which is difficult, but I was thinking about how they have to play road games for all of these because they didn't bid to have the games here. So if you just look at the men's NIT bracket, for instance, it would be tough to play, let's say, at Northeastern and then at Stanford and then at Maryland.
Right, yeah, like you're that. Going across the country.
So to do the equivalent of that, plus an extra game because they play, and they weren't seeded high enough where whoever they played first wasn't good.
Right.
So to have to play as many teams on the road as they did, be they NIT teams or otherwise, and win those games is pretty impressive. How does that... Maybe it doesn't... I don't believe in there being like some kind of direct carryover, but how do they set up for next year with what they have coming back?
Yeah, the road issues were pretty huge during the regular season. I think they only won like three games in the conference on the road, and they were all pretty bad. And they were actually only the second team to make the WNIT Final Four by way of four road games, so that was pretty impressive. And I think, you know, the momentum after, you know, 8 or 9 months off or however long it is, you don't necessarily carry it over, but you do take the lessons that you learned. And I think the biggest thing that they learned was Sydney Moss is going to carry them. She's going to be their best player, most likely. But they've got a bunch of really good players coming in and a lot of players that are going to be eligible. You've got Ronnie Williams, who was the number 13 overall recruit in the class of 2013, the best player in the state of Florida. She's the highest recruit that Amanda Butler's ever gotten. She's going to be there. She's going to be a nice addition. She's a swing, kind of like a two or three. You've got Cassie Peoples, who transferred from Texas, a former McDonald's All-American like Ronnie Williams, who's going to be eligible next season. She's going to help lock down the point guard system or spot. They've also got Victoria Diamante. She's, I think, 6'4", 6'5". Yeah. She's got a lot of size, and she's kind of... She's from Lithuania? Is that where she's from?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. Don't ask us like you're the one who wouldn't...
Yeah.
She's, you know.
Yeah, she's...
Who's the only player they lose? Jennifer George?
Yeah, Jennifer George.
She was hurt a lot of times during the year. So
yeah, she had a huge junior
it's not like,
year.
It's not like there. It's going to be a new experience playing without her.
Right, yeah.
They had a lot of games where she just wasn't in there because of her shoulder.
Yeah, I think the thing you take from the women's basketball season this year is like, ultimately, at Florida, success is measured by NCAA tournaments when it comes to basketball. But I really feel like that Butler... I mean, I've been critical of Amanda Butler's coaching job, but I will say that in the NIT, she really showed me something with her coaching that, you know, I've been waiting to see. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that this run is proof that, you know, she's going to be a championship coach here, but I do think it's very promising, and she does have a lot of talent coming in. And I feel like if she can really put things together and keep doing the type of coaching job she did at the end of this year with this talent, then, I mean, maybe NCAA tournament becomes something that's finally an annual expectation.
Now, it is a team to watch. I mean, go ahead, Greg.
I was going
to
say, I won't blame you if you don't have, like, a grasp of the national women's college basketball scene, but it seems to me from an outsider's view that there's a top tier of, like, five or six teams who are just so much better than everybody else. Are they actually, like, going to get near that group or in it, or are they just too far away, like, with everybody else?
You know, that's not a realistic step in a 1 or 2 year scenario. I mean, the Baylor, Connecticut, Stanford, Notre Dame, that echelon of teams is probably not getting cracked by Florida. But at the same time, on the other hand, the SEC was probably, maybe with the Big East, the best women's basketball conference this season. Kentucky and Tennessee both got two seeds, and they both made runs to the Elite Eight, I believe.
I'm
also,
just clicking around now, and it looks like Georgia was a four.
Georgia was good. South Carolina was probably a four or five. So they had a number of teams who got high seeds, and there's just a lot of depth in the SEC. And Florida's not been able to even crack the top echelon of teams in the SEC the past few years. I think they've even in 2011-12, when they made the NCAA tournament, they finished eighth, and they finished in a tie for eighth this year. But with this talent, with Antoinette Bannister, another one who's coming in, she transferred from North Carolina with Peoples and Ronnie Williams and all these players coming together, it's going to be a big year to see, okay, can we move up to maybe third or fourth in the SEC? And if you get there, you're going to be ranked. I don't think this program has been ranked in 4 or 5 years. So, no, they're not going to get to the upper echelon. But if they can get into the 15 to 20 range, that's a huge step for Amanda Butler's program.
Now, there's been some talk about Amanda Butler's job security in the past. I think she's obviously safe right now. But does another bad season lead to those conversations, or is she kind of firmly entrenched at this point?
Yeah, I think if she struggles again and they, you know, do a similar type thing that they did this year, then that starts to become a conversation. If she starts to have all this talent there and can't really reap the benefits of it, then you start to wonder, okay, maybe we look in a different direction. But at the same time, from everything that I've heard from people I've talked to, the administration loves her fully. She's a great recruiter what you can see getting the number one player in the state of Florida. Obviously, recruiting at a place like Florida that's not established in women's basketball is difficult, but she's done a pretty good job with what she has. And she also played here. She played for 4 years. She started for 4 years. She's got roots in Gainesville. I think the administration really likes her, and they want to give her the benefit of the doubt. I think she's got definitely next year and then even maybe the following year to try and piece it all together. And if we're sitting here in 2 years where they haven't done anything, then I think it's probably time for her to go. But at this point, her job's pretty stable.
Yeah, if I'm sitting here in 2 years talking about women's basketball, it would not be a good outcome for me. All right, that's enough women's game, I think.
I have a quick transition before we go to men's basketball.
Okay.
Did you know there's a Dick Vitale fathead?
No, who would buy that? Is it his head or is it like a full body one?
It's like his full body. He's like wearing a suit.
I would consider the purchase.
Like, the Alligator Internet is blocking Deadspin right now, but like, according to Deadspin, there has been a Dick Vitale fathead for years.
Speaking of Deadspin, did you guys happen to catch the SNL spoof of the Mike Rice video?
I did not,
no.
Oh, well, after this podcast, make sure to catch it.
So. I haven't caught the Mike Rice video. So.
Yeah, he's just mean.
I figured, you know, I mean.
There could have been some pain involved for some of the players, but yeah, not a very great look for him. All right, men's game. Good work, Joe. Landon, you've been waiting around for a while, so I assume if I just turn it over to you, you'll be ready to go. Talk about the last two games of Florida season. Start with the Florida Gulf Coast game, 62-50 win, and then take us through the kind of meltdown, if you will, against Michigan, 79-59.
Florida Gulf Coast jumps out to a big lead. Florida responds, pulls away in the second half, shows that they're ultimately the better team, and that Florida Gulf Coast's run was just pure magic those first two games. Shut down the transition. Went half court, and that's basically that game, won by 12.
Yeah, Comer turned it over 9 times, which was a lot, and they turned it over 20 as a team, Gulf Coast did, so that was key there.
Yeah, Florida really got at it, like in the probably the final 25 minutes of the game, and really forced a lot of turnovers. Overall, 20 turnovers for the Eagles, so that was basically that game. And then Michigan, let's just say Michigan's really good. I mean, they're obviously going to play Louisville tomorrow in the title game, so Florida just got totally outmatched by a superior team. Michigan jumped out to a 13-0 lead. And you really know the story from there. Florida never had a close, so.
Florida, obviously, Landon covered the team better than I did, but Florida doesn't really match up that well with Michigan's players. I mean, they're really, really good.
Yeah.
When Michigan's on, they're probably the best team in the country.
They have a good shot at being Louisville tomorrow, I think. I mean, unless if Trey Burke has another poor game.
I mean, Florida, it happens. They got beat.
Right.
Did they even have a lead the entire game?
No.
I think so.
They never even cut it to single digits after Michigan led 13-0, I'm pretty sure.
So, it happens.
I turned it off to watch Friday Night Lights.
Wow. Right.
That's a bold play.
Glad we kept you on the show.
Yeah, but Mitch McGarry's really immersed in it. He's really the reason why Michigan has soared in this tournament, added balance.
That's another storyline because he really almost came to Florida.
He said on Saturday when I talked to him last Saturday that he had Florida as the number two option.
Florida, it was Florida, Duke, and Michigan. Obviously, he picked Michigan, but
yeah, he wanted to be closer to home.
If you look this, I see this Florida team. I was talking about this with a couple of people last night.
Mm-hmm.
If they get somebody like Mitch McGarry, and you have Brad Beal come back, I think you win the national championship.
Well, no, if they had Bennett as the one I always go to, because I think Anthony Bennett was as close to coming here as anybody.
Donovan, I feel like, would have disciplined them better. I mean, obviously, he's a huge talent, but that team was just totally undisciplined, the UNLV squad. They didn't really play very cohesive basketball.
I know, but if they get one, McGarry or Anthony Bennett, who's very good, and you have Brad Beal staying.
Even if Brad Beal doesn't stay, if you get a guy like Bennett to add to this mix, I mean, you never know really what can happen.
Right, yeah. McGarry. If a couple of things went their way in recruiting in the Beal process, they would have had one of the all-time teams, honestly, because they were really, really good this year. And I think what Pincus brought up is a good point. If you just talk about, let's just say you put all of the Florida and Michigan players into a pool, and we're going to have a draft, whether you're, I don't know if you're trying to build an NBA team or trying to build a college team, but either way, I think you would end up taking Hardaway, Burke, and McGarry before you take
anybody. Oh, for sure. Because they're the most ceiling.
Even maybe Glenn Robinson.
You'd have to at least think about it.
Yeah. Jacob Kurtz is your closer.
And you're not waiting so long before you take Stauskas either if you're looking for some 3 points.
And a lot of people don't really notice it from that one game when Michigan beat Florida that Glenn Robinson really played big just against Eric Murphy. He had a 4-inch differential. Like, he was 6'6", Eric Murphy 6'10", and
a really good
blocked him twice.
Yeah, I mean, and again, we talked about if they had one of those other guys, you would have been able to get Murphy out of there in this game because he said he wasn't sick, and from all purposes, from what we've heard and from people that have spoken about this, is he wasn't on game day. He had dealt with something earlier in the week and missed practice on Tuesday, but supposedly just had a terrible, terrible game against Michigan, finished 0-11.
Yeah, you got to feel for him, too.
I mean, yeah, very unfortunate for him, but that's a key to that game, and I think, you know, I think if they played this game over a bunch of times, Michigan would be the better team, and they are. But I think Florida can win a bunch of those because the way this game was going to work out is it was going to just come down to jump shooting.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the rebounding, and it was so close. Florida was out-rebounded by one, and they both had the same number of offensive rebounds. You know, turnovers were within four. Florida had 15. Michigan had 11. It's always just going to kind of come down to who makes their shots and who doesn't. And when Stauskas goes 6-for-6 and Eric Murphy goes 0-for-11, that's a 20-point swing in and of itself.
Yeah, and in that game, Florida went 2-of-10 from 3. And remember the days when we used to just talk about Florida always take like 50% of their shots from 3?
Yeah.
Less than 20 in this game, so totally went away from their identity.
I guess they said it was partly because for as good as McGarry's become, he's definitely not a shot blocker, and that wasn't something they were too worried about. And it's understandable to me, but I don't know. I guess it's sort of dance with what brought you there, that sort of thing. And I think they just got away from that and took their lowest number of three attempts of the season and hit their lowest number of threes for the season. And one of those was, I think it was Dylan Graham hit one with like a minute to go. They had one for most of the game, and it was the first time they'd had one since like 3 seasons ago.
Yeah, so it seems really bizarre for a Billy Donovan-led team to just have an identity crisis in the Elite Eight. You kind of look at them going in, and you think, okay, well, obviously, like we've talked about, they're going to shoot a lot of threes. And no, McGarry and Glenn Robinson aren't traditional shot blockers, but hey, like, how about you play your game and not worry so much about some of the other pieces?
Yeah, that's definitely what I wasn't at the game, but that's what they're talking about on the telecast on, I think it was on CBS, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's what they're talking about, how, you know, Florida's just trying to shove it inside, and it's just not working.
Right. You could tell from the first two plays of the game, Eric Murphy's going inside, and Glenn Robinson, I think, blocks him both times and really sets the tone for the game. By the time Florida even realizes what's going on, they're down 13-0, and at that point, it's just you're trying to play catch-up, and you see this time and time again where teams get down big and try and hit these 4- or 5-point shots. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're shooting a lot of three-pointers, but they're trying to do these things that aren't a part of their natural game. And I think Florida fell into that trap.
Yeah, and with Murphy's struggles, McGarry held Young to just kind of a subpar game. And then at the same time, John Horford coming off the bench had 6 points and 4 rebounds. He also provided kind of a boost to Michigan's front court. So it was really just, it just collapsed on Florida. Kind of knew that they wanted to attack because they knew that Florida also struggled against Florida Gulf Coast from three, so I don't think Florida is really comfortable from beyond the arc in Cowboy Stadium.
John Horford, a guy, Al Horford's brother. I don't think Billy Donovan even recruited him to Florida.
No,
yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of weird.
So, for Florida, this is their third straight loss in the Elite Eight. And
I think the previous two sting way more than this one.
When you get beat by a team that's clearly better than you, just understand, okay, well, this team was better than us.
It's slightly ironic just because all season we talked about the whole late game struggle thing and the lack of clutch or, I don't know,
close games,
quote unquote,
like that.
The team was 0-6 this year, and games decided by six or less, I'm pretty sure.
By single digits.
Or single digits, yeah. So it was just ironic just to have the worst loss of the season come at like a game like this where we expect it to be close.
And yeah, not play a single-digit game the whole tournament. Mm-hmm. We talked about the talent disparity, and when we say Michigan's clearly the better team and all that, Florida's still going to finish the year second nationally in the overall efficiency ratings. And I think when you talk about that on paper they were the better team, given that their talent is so much less, I think that says a lot about the job Billy Donovan did with this team.
He's becoming a legend. I mean, let's be honest. And if hopefully he stays here, we'll get the whole court named after him. He'll be here forever. And he's one of the elite coaches in the college basketball landscape, hands down.
That's logistics.
Yeah.
There you go.
He did a hell of a job this year, just considering he didn't have a ultra-talented freshman class come in, which won't be the case next year. But, I mean, he had a solid core of upperclassmen and did really well with that. I mean, next year might be even a better team.
Just looking at the team, they're all veteran guys. Billy's been working at them for, 3 years. Like, this was his team. You know, you have Boyden, Young, Murphy. They've been here a while. They've played under Billy Donovan, and they really, you could see Billy Donovan's stamp on this team with their defense.
Mm-hmm. You're right, yeah. He's really been tinkering with these guys. Yeah. You can see the things that, with Patrick Young, he sat him out a few times here and there over the last couple of years, just trying to get in his head a little bit to just do the things that he wanted him to do. And same thing with
you could see Billy Donovan's stamp on the Gators this season, mm-hmm. and it showed on the court because they had a really good season.
Yeah. Now, we're already coming up on an hour and 20 minutes here, so we will not look ahead to next year, but I do want to take this point because we want to wait and see what happens with Patrick Young with the NBA draft and whether he's going to leave or come back. That obviously has a big impact on our look ahead. But I do want to talk about the seniors, and we talked about what Billy Donovan's done. We'll start with Mike Rosario, even though he was here the shortest amount of time, but to make him from this guy that couldn't be trusted and was going to turn the ball over a lot, take a lot of bad shots, and do a lot of stupid things to playing as much as he did in the tournament, being as good as he was in the tournament, getting named to the South All-Region team, and being actually a valuable player by the time his career was over here.
I mean, everybody expected him to be this huge contributor when he first came here. And I think overall, he met some expectations this year, but he wasn't a spectacular 19-point-per-game player at Rutgers. But at the same time, he was kind of a high-volume shooter there. So
yeah.
I feel like he lived up to expectations this year, but last year he was just a disappointment. So overall, I'd say his Florida career was pretty average, not anything amazing, but he was just a solid player.
I kind of mentioned this on the last podcast, and within the last 3 or 4 years, I think Rosario was Billy Donovan's best work as a coach.
Absolutely.
No, he didn't finish as, a 19-point scorer, but that's not what this team needed, and it's not what they asked him to do. This is a guy who comes in as, little more than a total head case. I mean, you've got him just doing almost nothing last year, missing 10 days for just little things that Billy Donovan was really critical of, to the point where here in the NCAA tournament, this guy's taking, not only is he dropping 25, but he's taking good shots, he's playing defense, he's playing smart, he's looking more like Kenny Boynton than Mike Rosario of 2 years before, and Kenny Boynton is like Billy Donovan's like prototypical player that he wants to see everybody, and you could start to see some of the Kenny Boynton in Mike Rosario. I mean, yeah, he's still had some mistakes and stuff, and with anybody you're going to, especially a guy who's kind of, as mercurial as Rosario's been in his career, but I think Donovan did a great job with him.
I just remember one of their earlier games that I covered from the Gators this season. They played maybe Alabama State or one of those.
Yeah, one of the really early games. It was probably Southeastern Louisiana where he dropped like 21, 22.
And Rosario just went off, had a great game, and all the comments after were like, Billy's been so hard on Mike, his first, last season, and he's now finally turning the corner. And it's interesting because not every player can coach like that. But what, Billy did was he saw, Rosario's a, Jersey kid. He played for, Bobby Hurley, legendary coach in high school. So he knew what makes him tick. And you could see that, Rosario really came into his own this season.
And Donovan's way of thinking, something that really resonates with me that you saw a lot with Rosario, is he wasn't basing his post-game comments and how he's feeling about Rosario on necessarily the results.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Billy Donovan's a guy who really buys into the process that you take to get to these results. And the results, some of it is with luck. I mean, shots are going to fall some nights, and they're not going to other nights. But Billy Donovan really got Rosario to buy into this process that you need to be successful on a consistent basis and put yourself in the best situation, and I think he did that.
Yeah, it's a shame for Florida that Donovan really only had 2 years of Rosario being eligible, because if Rosario initially maybe committed to Florida and Donovan had 4 years, he could have molded him into a really mature and maybe even NBA-caliber player. He could have been solid at the shooting guard position maybe at the next level, but I mean, there's still facets of his game that probably will hold him back from that, and he probably won't get drafted, but if he had 2 more years, he could have been that type of weapon.
It'll be interesting to see where that goes for sure. Another senior, Kenny Boynton, ends as the school's second all-time leading scorer. Will always, hopefully, not be remembered too much for the lack of clutch shots and things that didn't fall for him at the end of games, but was a very consistent scorer, didn't turn the ball over a lot, played good defense without ever fouling, kind of did what the team needed him to do at different points, and I just thought did a solid job running the offense, especially this year, and was always there when they needed a bucket. So, I mean, talk about Kenny Boynton.
Just from a lineup standpoint, he's easily been Florida's most consistent player. Maybe just historically, he only missed he didn't actually miss a game at Florida, but he only did not start in 3 games.
Yeah.
Out of 140-something. So he's always been there. He's always been reliable. I mean, obviously, yeah, he was a little streaky this year, but just he's always been there to provide the points and shots when Florida needs them. So.
Yeah, Boynton was always a streaky guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was kind of his thing where the first couple of years he'd have huge nights of scoring mm-hmm. and other nights where it wasn't so much. And this year he didn't do as much of the scoring. I think this is probably what he'd average, like 12 points a game, something like that. And it's another guy where this team didn't need him to score that much every night.
Exactly.
Like we said a little bit before, Billy Donovan was tinkering with all these parts and got Boynton to buy into this, look for other guys first, then get yours. And I think that made him a better all-around player for it. His statistics might not necessarily look like that, and people want to stick this unclutched label on him. But mm-hmm. I still think he had a really nice season and obviously a tremendous career.
Yeah, like what I mean from a consistency standpoint is, like, obviously he's had scoring issues sometimes this year, but he provides the other things. Like, he's improved his rebounding, his assists were up. Like, one game he'd maybe have, like, 2 points and 7 assists. It's still a pretty solid game. He's helping right. his teammates out, and they're flourishing. So, overall, just consistent, not necessarily from a scoring standpoint, but just from an overall basketball standpoint.
And then the last senior we have to talk about is Eric Murphy, who had a very interesting career arc with not doing much for 2 years, then having the arrest with Cody Larson that was obviously kind of a black mark on his off-the-field career, and mm-hmm. Something Donovan talked about, making him mature as a person in addition to maturing as a player. And now this season to become, you know, one of the most deadly scoring threats in the SEC with what he can do from beyond the arc, shooting 45.3%, even with the dreadful last game. I mean, just talk about what his value was this year and how he's going to be remembered as his Florida career has looked back on.
Well, he's really improved, first off, just his NBA draft stock. I mean, before this season, he wasn't even considered. Now he could probably be a late second-round pick, maybe in the line of those types of players like Steve Novak or Matt Bonner. I'm not going to say he's necessarily going to be as good as them, but you know what I'm saying. But,
right.
But he's really just improved in the post. I remember at the beginning of the season, that was kind of an issue where, like, he couldn't box up or just post up at all. And he kind of showed some facets of that this year. Obviously, he preferred to stay on the perimeter and be that stretch forward, but he showed a little bit of inside game this year and really helped out his overall point average.
Well, it seems like with Billy's offense, there always needs to be a stretch four.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric Murphy fulfilled that role to a T. I mean, he was arguably one of Florida's most valuable, you know, offensive players. I mean, he made shots consistently. I think if you look at the stats, probably their best three-point shooter.
Oh, yeah. Or second best by average, but he took more threes than Frazier. So. Yeah.
So, I mean, Eric Murphy, the best thing about him is he took on this role and he fulfilled it, you know, didn't hold back, great shooter, really just did his job, you know, night in, night out. Obviously didn't end like everybody wanted it to, but that really, we should throw that out and appreciate
mm-hmm.
what he did for, you know, his 4 years here.
Yeah, whenever he played well, this team was just he just put the team over the top whenever he would have a big performance. And when he would struggle, the team would always lose. So I feel like he was just that guy that really gave the Gators another dimension. Like, obviously, he wasn't always necessarily consistent, had some bad games here and there. Never really often back-to-back bad games. Maybe in the tournament, but not throughout the course of the season. But whenever he would have a bad game, Florida just wouldn't be the same. And I feel like
right.
when he did have those big performances, that Florida was almost an impossible team to beat.
Now, do you think as a group these guys are going to be remembered for what they did in terms of not getting to the Final Four and being so close, or are they going to be remembered for all the wins and getting this team back on track after the back-to-back NITs?
I feel like a fraction of it is going to be obviously the Final Four. That's what this Gator fans are just like that. They've been spoiled by 2006, 2007. But at the same time, a lot of people will look at it and just see the consistency that Florida's had. I'm pretty sure that's right, that no team has made it to the Elite Eight for the past 3 years besides Florida.
Yeah, they're the only one.
Yeah, they're the only one. So just from that standpoint, they'll really be looked at as reviving Donovan's program and from a consistency standpoint. But at the same time, it will be a little bit tainted just by not making the Final Four.
I don't think you can look past the previous two Elite Eight performances. I mean, they're just so close. And yet, you know, they didn't get over the hump, close out, you know, Butler and Louisville. This group of seniors played great. Three Elite Eights, that's a huge accomplishment. But, I mean, two second half, you know, collapses in the biggest game of the season. It's big opportunity lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they missed out on some key opportunities, but at the same time, you have to think back, like 4 or 5 years back, when their best player was Nick Calathes, and they really did not have a deep roster at all, and they were just struggling to find talent. And Chandler Parsons obviously wasn't the player that he became now, so that was really not a very inconsistent and undisciplined team. And just to look at what Kenny and Eric have done just to bring back this program, it's night and day, but you're right, those losses were very disappointing, heartbreaking for Florida fans, so it kind of does put a little bit of a chip on the whole legacy.
Yeah, so again, we'll see where this program goes next year, and we'll see what those guys end up doing professionally. But
are we doing predictions for the national title game?
You know what, why not? Go ahead.
Florida fans are going to hate me for this, but go Blue.
All right, you got Michigan. Landon?
I went to high school with Tim Hardaway Jr., if anybody was wondering.
Oh, I was wondering.
Miami Palmetto Hutt Senior High.
Is he your homeboy?
Stand up.
People from Miami will always let you know where they're from.
Yes, exactly.
Landon? Present.
I want to pick Michigan, but I think Louisville's going to win by like 4 or 5.
Phil?
I like Michigan.
Joe?
Michigan by 6.
Wow, a lot of Michigan love. Okay, I'm taking Louisville because, aside from yesterday, they've been just so much better than everybody
else.
I think somebody's going to struggle on Michigan.
Well, no, a better prediction or over-under. How many times do we see Kevin Ware? I think 15, 20 maybe?
20, yeah.
Yeah,
20, Kevin Ware on the sidelines, probably 20
If they win, he's the whole victory shot. Everything is, check out Kevin Ware, they won. I don't know. I would never say that I don't think like his whole deal is super important and very cool and all, but it's like, I think people get hurt all the time. Like, it was gruesome and it was ugly.
It was one
like,
of the most gruesome sports injuries ever, but the whole process is kind of getting a little milked out. Like, it was obviously a horrific injury, and he does deserve some attention, but I think it's turning in too big of a deal, you were saying.
It's not like Remember the Titans when Gary got paralyzed, you know? I mean, like,
yes.
Kevin Ware is going to walk again, you know?
Yeah. My thing is, like, if...
Or, like, Eric LeGrand, yeah, like, that might have been just the worst. Everybody's forgetting about that.
If his bone doesn't pop out of his leg, and it's just a severely broken leg that's displaced... He's not getting nearly this amount of airtime. It's that wow factor of, wow, we just saw this guy's leg bust out of his skin. Now let's talk about it. But, I mean, I think it's a cool story the way that the guys rallied around him and the way that he's, like, come back pretty much already from it. I mean, he's still obviously going to deal with the rehab and stuff. But, yeah, at this point, I would like to see them just focus on the game and the players on the court.
Well, my thing is, like, I'm all for the kind of injury and playing for him and all that stuff narrative, but... Wichita State has a guy who's out for the year, and I don't think anybody's ever heard of him. And
right.
I don't know. Also a reserve player, also a bench guy.
Well, Hancock?
Louisville.
Didn't he replace Kevin Ware? I think that's what they're saying. He kind of took over Kevin Ware's minutes.
But the guy who did is Henderson, that walk-on who hit the threes.
Yeah, those were a couple of big threes.
Those were Kevin Ware's
without
minutes.
Without those threes, Wichita State might move on.
So that was very interesting. But, yeah, no, point taken that they're just fine without him on the court. And I think off the court, it's cool and all, but a lot
did
of people get it all the time.
Did you buy your Rise to the Occasion Kevin Ware t-shirt from Adidas?
I have not, but apparently you have a lot of Kevin Ware t-shirts to choose from if you're really into that sort of thing. They're really cashing in on this guy.
Last thing is Musburger calling the game? Is there any way that... Oh. We could get AJ McCarron's girlfriend into the stands next to Kevin Ware because I think the internet might explode if
nice.
That were the case.
Easily.
Nice.
Johnny Manziel's girlfriend, too.
Yeah, she's...
Jeremy Lin makes an appearance. Tim Tebow shows up.
Wow, yeah, this is getting
out of control. That would be unbelievable. All
right, so we're approaching the hour and a half mark, which means we should go, but also that if anybody's here still listening, they will listen to literally anything you guys have to say. So I don't know if anybody has, like, a parting shot, because you know the devoted listeners aren't tuning out at this point.
NBA playoffs, April 20th. That's all I have to say.
There you go.
Right. Follow me on the Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
We need to get my followers.
We'll just skip to that part, then. You can find us on Twitter at Alligator Sports. I'm at Greg Luca. Pincus, you're...
At Adam D. Pincus.
What's the D stand for?
Daniel. It's my middle name.
Okay.
Nice. Landon.
At Landon Watnick.
Phil.
At Philip underscore Heilman.
Joe.
Joe underscore Morgan.
All right. That took way too long. You can...
Do we want to do another 5-second movie review?
Think of one while I rattle off the other things.
All right.
You can pick up a copy of the paper, as always. Like we said, if you hurry out there, you can still get one of the copies from Friday with the Antonio Morrison feature. Otherwise, we'll have all kinds of great spring game and other sports stuff for you on Monday and throughout the week. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can find us on Facebook.com/AlligatorPodcast. You can like that page. I think that's everything. So, Joe, do you have your review ready?
Maybe Silver Linings?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have another one?
I'll have one next time.
Oh, all right.
Super disappointing. Okay.
Super teams. All right.
Also, shout out to Greg Luca for wearing a 2008 AFC East Division Champion T-shirt for the Miami Dolphins.
Hell yeah, dude.
Is that Jay Fiedler?
I present. No, this is the Chad Pennington.
Chad Pennington. Yeah, crazy to get those two confused.
Shout out to Chad Pennington.
Yes.
All right.
So, nice job on the shirt choice.
Thanks, man. All right. So, solid show. We'll be back one time before the end of the year. Maybe we'll have some football things to discuss. Maybe we'll talk a little NFL draft.
Maybe baseball?
I don't see why not.
Basketball future. I mean, Pat Young's probably got to make his decision by April 16th. So.
That's going to be the key. When we hear from Patrick Young, then we will be back to talk about next basketball season, and you won't have to wait an hour into the show to hear anything about it. We covered a lot of ground today. Good work, everybody. We will see you next time, and until then, thank you for listening.